All right. So right now I'm joined with Catherine Harold, who's with the Associated Press, based in Nairobi, covering East Africa. Thank you very much for joining us, Catherine.
It's such a pleasure.
Okay, so you've been covering the famine in East Africa. And specifically the problems with food aid and some of the things that are going on with food aid being stolen. So could you kind of explain the situation right now?
Absolutely. I just returned from a trip to Mogadishu about a week and a half ago. And, you know, there's terrible scenes there. Lots of children who look skeletal, you know, mothers that have walked for days on bleeding feet to try and get help. Nobody can deny that there's a humanitarian emergency going on there at the moment. But part of the problem is that Somalia has been at civil war for more than 20 years now. And there are certain people there who have made fortunes off of ripping off aid agencies and ripping off foreign diplomats who want to pump money into the country. And those people are stealing and selling food aid, you know, by the truckload, many, many truckloads, which means that the starving people aren't actually getting the aid that would help them survive.
With this aid, I mean, people in Canada, you know, they see these images and they give this money, but it seems like there's always this disconnect between, well, I'm going to give, you know, $20, but, you know, how does that $20 get used or whatever? So maybe could you kind of explain the process of when aid gets there, sort of what happens to it?
Well, obviously, when aid gets there partly depends on how it gets there and how it gets distributed. Partly depends on who gets the money, where they're working. WFP, for example, works in a different way to the Red Cross, which works in a different way to Doctors Without Borders. Honestly, if people do want to give money to the famine, which is fantastic and admirable, then they probably aren't going to have a huge amount of influence over how big aid agencies spend their money. But if they were interested in solving the problem of corruption in Somalia, which feeds off the hungry, feeds off the starving, feeds off the conflict, then they could certainly get in touch, for example, with their Canadian MPs to look at legislation for Somalis that have dual citizenships. There's many people who live and work in both countries. But to be honest, they're probably not going to have a lot of influence over how the aid agencies spend their money.
So could you kind of explain who's profiting off of this? I mean, is it just militants, or do you also have, like, businessmen who are kind of profiting off of the stolen aid?
Well, there's businessmen and militants are often the same people in Somalia. People who have large contracts with foreign aid agencies often have to maintain their own militias because they're responsible for seeing that that aid is delivered. They have to pay a fine if it's not delivered. The problem comes because the aid agencies don't have many foreigners on the ground, so they rely on local Somali aid groups to distribute the aid, but they don't carry out proper checks on them. So, for example, we found a warehouse right behind one of the WFP's former main contractors, and food was being sold directly from that warehouse to the markets. Eight businessmen named a contractor that WFP says now has been suspended as their source of food, and there's not sufficient checks within the system to ensure that food aid isn't being stolen.
As far as those specific checks, I mean, is it just kind of an offshoot of the situation you have in Somalia with the chaos, or is it, or is there more, something more that the aid agencies or for example, like the Canadian government could do to kind of fix the situation?
Basically, I spoke to a consultant here who works a lot on aid issues in Somalia, but nobody's going to pretend that all the aid is going to get to the starving. That never happens, even in situations much less chaotic than Somalia. What's unclear is whether the large agencies have put enough effort into ensuring that there are checks in their system. That, for example, they've diversified their contractors, that they've diversified the people who give out the food. If you're reliant on one Somali NGO to distribute, say, half of your food aid, and you find out that that NGO is stealing from you, you may not be able to act because you could lose your access.
Now, as far as we talk about this chaotic situation, I've also been reading, some people are kind of arguing that there needs to be more intervention, maybe more troops on the ground. I understand that there's a African Union troops there. Do you think that that's enough to solve these problems, or do you think there needs to be more, like almost like a NATO intervention or UN, more UN involvement to protect the aid and make sure that it's going to the proper places?
Well, the Associated Press correspondents don't have opinions on such issues, and if we do, we're certainly not allowed to discuss them publicly. What I will say is that there is currently 9,000 African Union troops on the ground. They have secured the capital with the help of some Somali troops, but whoever is on the ground is going to have to leave one day. So the only real long-term solution is to build a Somali government and a Somali army that is capable and has an incentive to provide security and services for its own people. At the moment, they get money and arms and support whether or not they provide security or services to their own people.
Hmm. I'm kind of looking at, ahead into the future. If you know all this aid is pouring in, but there's also the certain amount that's being siphoned off, and I guess one would assume that a lot of these things are being siphoned off to some of these people that breed conflict. Is it just going to be a kind of a perpetual thing with Somalia, kind of almost like just keep on digging the hole and not being able to kind of get out of it?
Well, I disagree with people who think that there's, you know, it's always going to be violent or it's always going to be a war because, you know, it's Somalia or it's Africa or something like that. You know, you have to look at the economic causes of a conflict. Who's benefiting? Who is making money from it? And those people have been identified, but not much has been done to prevent them from continuing to profit from the situation. Interestingly, the UN Arms Monitoring Group on Somalia, which produces the report for the UN every year detailing who should be put under sanctions list, and by that I mean an asset freeze and a travel ban, has now had corruption added to their mandate in addition to arms smuggling. So the UN has now sort of officially said this year that corruption in Somalia is as big a contributor to the conflict as arms smuggling, but it remains to be seen whether they can take any action on that.
So is it just when you talk about it remains to be seen if they need to take action, is it just a matter of perhaps they don't have the proper, I guess, teeth to do it, or is it just a matter of them kind of getting organized to be able to do it?
Well, they do have the teeth. Basically, what the sanctions group can do is they can put people under a travel ban, which means that they can't fly. They can't leave the country that they're residing in, and they can also seize their assets, which means houses, bank accounts held in foreign countries. Now, they've been able to do this to arms dealers for a long time and have done to some pirate leaders. But the problem is, if you are living in Somalia, there's not much way that people can enforce that. But if you have dual citizenship and you're living outside of Somalia and you have assets outside of Somalia, then that could worry you, and possibly it might cause people to change their behavior.
Excellent. Well, we'll have to leave it there. But thank you very much for giving your time to do this interview, Catherine. Really do appreciate it. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Joined with Feroz Manji, who's the editor-in-chief of Pambazuka News. Thank you very much for joining me, Feroz.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Yes. So I guess for our listeners that aren't familiar with Pambazuka, could you please just kind of give a brief description of what it is?
Sure. Pambazuka News is a Pan-African newsletter which has been going for about 10 years. It's an e-newsletter and a website. It has a readership of about 500,000. And there are about nearly 3,000 authors across the continent who write regularly for Pambazuka News.
Mm-hmm.
And the website is www.pambazuka, PambazukaUK.org, and you can find more than 75,000 items on the website there.
Yes, excellent. And just for our listeners to know, it is a great website, and I do encourage them to go and look up and look at it often for articles and updates and actually great analysis of what is going on around the world. But I wanted to do this interview with you about right now the current famine in East Africa. It has gotten a substantial amount of media attention. Although it's the point here with this interview is the kind of story that the media is presenting. So, I mean, is the media, when they're covering the famine in East Africa, do you think that they're really reporting on what is happening and the issues they're in, or are they more promoting a stereotype of Africa?
I think it's a very good question. I mean, I think there's no doubt that what we're getting presented is very much a stereotype, in the sense that what they are doing is describing the appalling situation that many people face in terms of lack of food, but are guilty of silences, I mean, deafening silences. Why is it that so many people are starving? Why is it that it's happening now? Why is it that the situation in Somalia, for example, is creating so many refugees? And I think there has been almost total silence as to what the cause of it is. The first thing I think that they are silent about is the fact that food prices across the world have gone up extraordinarily high. In the last 6 months alone, they've increased by nearly 300%. Now, that's not because there's a shortage of food. It's because people are speculating. The stock market, speculators and gamblers on the stock market are gambling on the price of food. And as a result, you have more than a billion people across the world who are officially described as hungry and undernourished, not because there isn't enough food. In fact, there is more than enough food, but because they cannot afford it. The price of food has been far too high. Even the World Food Program, who's trying to provide food to those who have in the crisis in East Africa, cannot afford to buy enough food to meet the needs. The second thing has been the political crisis that has been created by the U.S. In Somalia. Every time that the people of Somalia have tried to sort out their own solutions, the U.S. has either intervened directly or encouraged Ethiopia and others to intervene, so that they can form a government which is to their liking, not to the liking of the Somali people. I think these are some of the things that the media tends to be deafeningly silent about. And, of course, it plays directly into the prejudice that people have of Africans as being merely victims rather than actors and makers of their own destiny.
Mm-hmm. Kind of on to the point of the stereotype of Africans not being able to make their own destiny, you also hear the term failed state a lot when they talk about Somalia and a lot of other places in Africa. But I mean, is it really fair to call Somalia a failed state, or is this term in your eyes kind of more pejorative?
Well, I think, you know, Noam Chomsky assessed the criteria for describing a failed state, and his conclusion was that the one state in the world that can be described as a failed state is the United States of America. That is a fundamentally undemocratic failed state. What Somalia is not a failed state. It's a country in which the state has been destroyed, not least by the intervention by the Americans. There is now a track record of creating, through armed intervention, failed states. We have seen this in Afghanistan. We've seen this now in Iraq. We've seen more recently in Libya. And I think this is a beginning of a trend that you will see that the U.S. will intervene militarily, either directly or behind the mask of NATO. They are creating failed states. And the reason why that is so profitable is that it allows them to exploit and to turn the direction of resource extraction and access to resource and enable them to have their strategic positions within Africa and in the Indian Ocean and the Middle East. That is what they have been trying to do. Palestine is perhaps another long-term example of how the State of Israel has been used to create a failed state as such. What America tries to do is to create other states in its own image, and that is therefore not surprising that it seeks to create failed states.
Mm. Now, when talking about the intervention, and you said there's the long record of this intervention, that military intervention into Somalia. And I mean, and really in Africa, if you look at the history of the continent, I mean, colonialism, I mean, it doesn't take much more than just at least a shallow read into the history to see how that affected the continent. But talking specifically about Somalia, to talk about a bit about that track record. I mean, it is a long list, unfortunately. But I mean, and also into the fact of, if you want to talk about failed states, they also supported Ethiopia, which is a highly undemocratic country in Africa, to intervene into Somalia. So talk a bit about that.
Precisely. And you know, that puts paid to all the mythology and propaganda about the intentions of the U.S. to create democratic, to spread democracy. What they are seeking to spread is control over vast sectors of the continent. And I think this is a really dangerous situation. They've already paid the price previously of their intervention. And ever since then, every time that they have that the Somalis have tried to establish some kind of a state and some kind of government which would allow some peace to be brought to across the country, the Americans have sought to disrupt that because it is not in their interest to have Somalians use democracy to choose their own government, their own values, their own way of operating, but rather to become client states.
Yes. Now, in talking a little bit more about the crisis itself, there's also, I mean, I've read a lot of reports about the kind of the dubious nature of a lot of these aid agencies. What is your opinion on this? Are they just sort of propagating in a lot of cases, some people would even argue that they're making the situation worse by what they're doing there. What do you think of that?
I think that many of these international NGOs, the so-called humanitarian intervention, and remember the term humanitarian intervention was used by King Leopold in his occupation of the area of Africa known as the Congo, and it is a classic statement that's a humanitarian intervention. Libya was supposed to be a humanitarian intervention. And the NGOs, the development NGOs, the humanitarian NGOs, are very much a part of the problem. They provide precisely the kind of excuse that the media reports on as it being something that, you know, really requires just pity rather than an opposition to the political intervention and military intervention which the U.S. and others have carried out. I think one of the serious crimes of the international NGOs is, in a sense, to depoliticize the nature of these situations, so that they no longer talk about what has caused it. They no longer talk about opposing U.S. imperialism. They no longer talk about opposing the Ethiopian intervention in Somalia. They no longer talk about the attempts to extract resources across Africa. Rather, they provide a nice liberal cover so that they can benefit. And remember that, you know, they have a vested interest in crises. The more crises they are, the greater justification for their existence. And they attract huge amounts of resources from the public, in a sense lying to the public that they are there to solve problems. Well, 60 years down the line, since they, many of them started operating, we're not seeing much of a change in the way in which the situation in Africa is. In fact, the situation for most people in Africa during the last 30 years has been worse than ever. There are more hungry people today, there are more unemployed people, there are more landless people, and most of these international organizations are strikingly silent, like their media counterparts, about the causes of this. So they don't oppose the oligopolies, the multinationals, from exploiting resources as they want. They don't oppose imperial interventions. Rather, they become part of the infrastructure of American intervention.
Hmm. And I guess just a final question. What about, I mean, aid agencies and the connection with the United States military, AFRICOM? Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, of course. I mean, AFRICOM is a very sophisticated and very extensive attempt to essentially occupy the territories of Africa. But it is not purely a military intervention. It is also an ideological one. And the way in which the NGOs then call upon essentially an imperial force, AFRICOM, to help them distribute their humanitarian assistance shows the level of alliance between an occupation force, because that is what AFRICOM is, and the international NGOs. I mean, one of the problems historically has been that the international NGOs they are today what the missionaries were under colonialism. The missionaries were there to provide the justification, the ideological justification for colonial occupation. Today, the international NGOs occupy the same missionary position vis-à-vis imperialism. But now they are serving not the interests of individual countries like the UK or France. They are essentially providing the service to the international financial institutions and multinationals who are seeking to occupy our countries.
Well, Feroz, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you so much for giving your time to do this interview and your insights and analysis of what is going on in Africa, but more specifically in East Africa. Thank you again for coming onto the show.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Yes, and for the listeners again, maybe just give the name of the of your website and where
the website.
They can,
you must check this out every week. It's Pambazuka News, and the website is www. pambazuka.org. So you're very welcome to sign up for free and to help us keep free and independent by making regular donations. Thanks for a lot.
Thank you very much, Feroz.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.